Lord, I thank you for this beautiful day that we have the privilege to be able to gather together and learn and grow, and hopefully that draws us nearer to you, because that's the ultimate goal, is for us to be near to you and your heart and your ways, your holiness, your love, all of those things. So Lord, I ask that you would help us to learn what we need to learn today, and be with us.
Amen. Thank you so much.
A greeting to continue heaven to my dream time. It's been
Mike wants to say something.
I want to say something if I can now. It's been 34 years that my dad died today. And so it's like so I have fun to bring that out to everybody.
Well, thank you for sharing
and
that.
So everybody will know where my heart is.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mike. We left our study in 1 Samuel. We were looking at Hannah and her difficulty with barrenness, and how God is very clearly the author of life. He's the author of conception, which is the beginning of life. He's the author of barrenness, which he can close a womb as well as he opens it. And he has his design and a reason to do so. And Hannah is stuck in a situation where she is grieving the fact that she does not have children, that she has another woman in the household who is incredibly fertile and is not only perhaps making her feel less than, but she is absolutely tormenting her and provoking her bitterly over the fact that she does not have children. Every year, this family comes to Shiloh, and as we said, they lived in Ramah, so it's less than 15 miles away, but nonetheless, they're faithful to come, and we're going to see just how faithful they are as we move along. But they're a godly family, and Elkanah is a godly man, even though somewhat clueless as far as the needs of his wife are concerned. And we left off last time by him being pretty male, pretty husbandly, when he says to his wife, who's grieving, and really grieving, And I think it's apparent that he isn't aware of all the needling that's going on between Peninnah and Hannah. But he simply says, "Look, you know, what's the big deal that you're barren? You have me." It's like, "Oh, that's a big help, right? Yeah, okay. Thanks for your sensitivity." But this is where we're going to pick up our story again today. If somebody would like to read 9 through 18, that would be wonderful. This is 1 Samuel 1, 9 through 18.
Then Hannah rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli, the priest, was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She greatly distressed, praying to the Lord, and wept bitterly. She made a vow and said, "O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head." Now it came about, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli was watching her. Now, As for Hannah, she was speaking in her heart, only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Then Eli said to her, "How long will you make yourself drunk? Put away your wine from you." But Hannah replied, "No, my lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation." Then Eli answered and said, "Go in peace, and may God of Israel grant your petition that you have of him." She said, "Let your maidservant find favor in your sight." So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad.
Okay. So it says that Hannah is distraught. She's greatly distressed, and literally that means bitter of soul. So she is really wrestling through this. Now, I find it interesting, it says year after year in verse 7, as they come to the house of the Lord. Now this is the tabernacle, but it's become far more permanent. They've got some sort of permanent structure about it. Not the building, of course, that Solomon will build, but just that it's more permanently located in Shiloh. They're not packing it up and moving it every little bit. But each year they come and they offer sacrifices, and it's a genuine event. But it's a particularly difficult and painful time for Hannah. So what is going on specifically, or why would this be the occasion of her greater bitterness of soul, or greater anxiety, greater heartache? Why is this it when she actually comes to the house of the Lord rather than sometime during the year? Do you think Peninnah has been relentless in her provocations during the year? I think there's an indication that she is, but something makes it particularly difficult when she's at the house of the Lord. What do you suppose is going on with Hannah each year at the house of the Lord? Okay, it's sort of a landmark each year. And it's not just the reminder that she doesn't have a child. But let's review what we said last week about Zacharias in chapter 1 of Luke. What was Zacharias doing in the temple? I mean, he was actually chosen for the fortnight to be the person that goes into the Holy of Holies. Not the Holy of Holies, he's not the high priest. But he was for 2 weeks going in morning and evening to trim the lamps, to change out the showbread, and to take care of the incense. What did we find him doing? What was the one thing in addition to that that he was supposed to be doing as the priest representing Israel each day?
Praying for
Israel. However, what do we find that he was really praying for?
His own situation,
which was, oddly enough, coincidentally enough,
a child.
He had a wife who was barren. They're now past childbearing. He's been praying the same prayer for how long? About 50 years. 40, 50 years. And Elizabeth has never had a child. So he's in there praying that God would grant them a child. And it's been such a long time, it's just rote to him now. He's just in there praying what he always prays, and he thought, well, I'm closer to God, I may as well be praying this too. The angel shows up and says, "Ha! God has heard your petition. He's going to answer. It's all wonderful." And Zacharias says, he doesn't believe a word he's been praying. He says, "Prove it." And the angel says, "Okay." As we said last week, shut up. And so it just shows you that this burden has been with him for all these years, and he's been praying. So if we back up and go back to 1 Samuel, do you think for 1 minute this was the first time that Hannah is praying to God passionately when they're at the temple. Do you think this was her first rodeo? No. So as Steve said, each year is more than just simply not having a child. Each year is a reminder, she thinks, she's misreading the moment, but she believes that for all these years, and Mary helped us last time, how many years has she been there? Vanina had all these children. She probably had 8, maybe 10. So we throw in. It's been like 15 years anyway that she's been barren. Yeah. So for 15 years, do you think she's been praying? Yes. Now, what is it that God's done? She prays. She comes back the next year. She prays. She comes back the next year. She prays. And so what has God done in her opinion?
Well, he hasn't done anything, but he's actually testing her.
Oh, no. I agree with you, okay? We have the advantage of hindsight.
Yes.
As each year goes by, what does she believe is the case? Well, God hasn't answered her, so therefore, these things that people are saying about her
must be true.
Might be true. So she's sitting there opening her heart to God like, you know, is there something wrong with me? Why don't I have a child? Please give me a child. Whatever the case may be, but it's an annual event that Stephen said, look, it's a reminder. Not only do I not have a child, but maybe I'm not okay with God. Or maybe he's displeased with me. Or, you know, why am I barren and all these other people aren't? So it's a painful time for her. And so we find, what is she doing in verse 7? She's weeping.
She's weeping.
Right? When she goes into the temple, what is she doing? Verse 10. She's weeping bitterly. Okay, so she is really distraught. Now, if you're really distraught, what is your countenance like?
Sad.
You're sad. You're somewhat agitated. You go into the temple. You're praying. You've been weeping constantly. What do your eyes look like?
They're red.
They're swollen. They're red. They're bloodshot. You know, and you're a little disheveled, maybe a little bit. I mean, I'm not saying that she's not, you know, she's like in tatters, but she just doesn't look her best. She can't look her best. So she's got the swollen puppy thing going on. She's got red eyes and all the rest of it. She's a bit agitated. And so what do you suppose? Oh, and then on top of it.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you suppose Eli thinks? She's just muttering to herself, not saying anything. He thinks.
She doesn't just think it, he says it.
Yeah.
Hey.
You're drunk.
So let's just look at what he does say. He goes, as she continues to pray before the Lord, that Eli was watching her mouth. As for Hannah, she was speaking in her heart, only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Is this a fair assessment? Is this a fair conclusion? Or do we condemn Eli for thinking this?
No. He had no idea.
It's somewhat logical. I mean, you're looking at this woman and things just don't look good or whatever. So, but here's the problem. Suppose she was drunk. Let's say for a minute she's polluted. And she comes into the temple. She's disheveled. Her eye, you know, whatever. What is his response to her? Does this sound like a loving, compassionate statement to Hannah?
No.
Get out of here, you drunk.
And he even asks, how long have you been intoxicated?
Yeah.
She's getting compassion from every man in her life.
Still today, it's very
sensitive.
Yeah, sensitive is right. And there is no laughter. No laughter at all during this time. Trying and trying, and it causes miracles. It infiltrates every area of everybody's life. But in Hannah's time, she didn't have social media to express her grief. She probably was looked down upon by everybody in her community, and so there was nobody she could share this with. And grief just piles on grief on grief on grief, and it's a horrible situation.
Suppose you were Job and you had some friends and you wanted to share the difficulties that you were going through.
Yeah. They judge you.
They just absolutely judge you. We'll get rid of the sin and God will bless you. So she went to her girlfriends and said, look, I'm dying here. Well, just get rid of the sin and you'll be okay. So, I mean, thank you. I mean, because that really was insightful, particularly from a lady's standpoint.
The other side is Eli. We know from other scripture, including what's known in Samuel, that he wasn't necessarily the most godly man. He didn't deal with his own sons, and he didn't deal with their sin, and he just let it go. And you know, so those kind of things give us some hint into his character. And so instead of seeing her as, this is a woman who comes in, she's married to a priest, she's coming in, she's weeping, she must have something deep in her soul. He's like, you drunk? And instead, you know.
Totally so agree.
He's totally on the wrong side as well.
I think you're right on. I mean, I think the assumption is he's just being.
He's just looking at the surface.
He's just looking at the surface. And the point is, he's not wanting to look beyond the surface. I mean, I'm sorry.
We see that in chapter 2, that he doesn't.
Oh, yeah, we're gonna explore that a little bit before we're done this morning. So, she goes, let's go back and see what she says before he makes this assumption. But somehow or other, it says that Hannah rose after eating and drinking. Now, first of all, it says that she's not eating and drinking. So, clearly, this is her responding to her husband coming to the table and pushing some food around on her plate, and then she's done. Because when you're distraught and you're upset, you're not hungry. So they have a meal, but she's not eating, and we'll see that in a minute. In Shiloh, now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the temple of the Lord, and she comes in. We've already described what she looks like. And this time, she does something different. She's been praying now for years that she might have a child. And this time, she's going to up the ante. And she is willing to make a vow, a special vow to God. If he will grant her a son, what will she do? What does it say in that verse? Somebody once again read verse 11. She made a vow.
Made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look upon the affliction of your maidservant, remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give to your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head.
So you can see a little bit of what we said before. She's greatly distressed, there's an affliction there, all this stuff. But see, and not forget thy maidservant. What does she believe God has done for the 15 years?
Forgot.
I mean, that's what's on her mind. That's what's on her heart. She says it out loud in prayer to God. So I think there's something to it. And then she says, look, if you will give me a son, I will what?
Give him to you. The Lord for service. That's what she's saying.
I will not only give him to you, I will not only dedicate him to you, I will.
She took on a Nazarite vow.
Nazarite vow. This is a big deal. This is not a small thing. A Nazarite vow. Well, we know of couple of those in the Bible, don't we? One she already knew about. There's one instance of a Nazarite vow that Hannah knows about. It happened not so many years previously. We're still in the time of judges. So if we just back up the clock a little bit, we'll find the judge who was a Nazarite. Samson. So again, Manoah has a wife. She is barren. The angel of the Lord shows up and says, hey, you're going to have a son. But when you do, this is what I want you to do. I want you not to consume any alcohol or wine or whatever. And he's not to have any wine. And he is to never cut his hair. And so there is a Nazarite vow from birth that we're given three instances of. Okay? From birth. This is reasonably rare compared to the Nazarite vow, because we'll look at it in a minute. So we have Samson. We have Samuel.
John the Baptist.
All three of which were dedicated to God from birth and were Nazarites, and as it says in about Samson, until his death or whatever. So we'll look at that in a minute. But let's look at the general thought or the general idea behind being a Nazarite or a Nazarite vow. It's in Numbers chapter 6. And oddly enough, we're going to look at several passages in Numbers today. I don't know why they all fall there. I'm sure it's a coincidence. So it speaks to this special vow. And again, just to very loosely connect it to something. Don't even look at it. Let's just read it as it is. So again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to dedicate himself to the Lord. So who's making the vow?
The individual.
The individual. And who's it going to affect?
Himself.
The individual. You're not doing it for someone else. He shall abstain from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar, whether made from wine or strong drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat flesh or dried grapes. All the days of his separation he shall not eat anything that is produced by the grapevine, from the seeds even to the skin. What? Why do you think that's such a big deal? I mean, what is this? Is God just concerned about them getting drunk? No. Why would this be part of it? And I guess you could relate it a little bit to fasting. Like if you dedicated yourself to fasting, what would you be really reminded of? Or when would you be really reminded of the fact that you were fasting?
When you're hungry.
When you're hungry, and at what time of day?
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
There you go. So as these things roll around, you're just nudged a little bit. Hey, I'm fasting. There's a reminder that I am purposely putting aside this time to honor God and to seek Him and to, you know, explore a deeper relationship with God, all the things that might happen during that time of fasting. How often do you think you bump into wine or the things or the grape in this culture?
All the time.
So as a little reminder, a little nudge, as you're going through your day and you're abstaining from anything to do with wine, you're going to be confronted by that again and again and again. So there's just this little reminder, hey, I've dedicated my life, I've dedicated this time, I've set apart a special time to the Lord. I'm not saying that it just can serve as a reminder as you're going through. It says, all the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall pass over his head. He shall be holy until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall let the locks of his hair on his head grow long. So what does that tell us? Is it permanent? Is it a permanent thing to become a Nazarite, generally?
It doesn't have a date.
No, the point is, I don't think it is.
Until the days.
I think the idea is that there's a time frame that you're putting aside, and it's not a week or two. I mean, if you're letting your hair grow long, then you're talking year plus or whatever. So, but when that time is up, I mean, like, as an adult, you're making the statement that I am presenting myself to God in a special vow for a special reason, all the rest of it. Now, that's the exception, of course, are the three Nazarites that we're told about that were dedicated to God from birth until death, all right? But now, the reason I say this is we're not done with that chapter. Just come on down to verse 13. Now, this is the law of the Nazarite. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, oh, there's an end to this. He shall bring the offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting. So there's this special offering that he's going to make when things are being fulfilled and it's all summed up. And in verse 18, the Nazarite shall then shave his dedicated hair, head of hair, at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and take the dedicated hair of his head and put it on the fire which is under the sacrifice of the peace offerings. So he's going to shave his head and even give his hair, his locks, as a sacrifice to God. Now, as odd as that may sound, we're given a perfect illustration of what this is. So if you'll turn to 2 Kings chapter 2, you'll come to one of our great heroes. You have the transition that's taking place between Elijah and Elisha. Elijah comes along and throws the mantle on Elisha. And there's this big thing. Oh, wow, me? Really? And so he starts following Elijah. I would suggest to you that in those early, in that time that he is following Elijah, he has made a vow to God, a special vow of a Nazarite, which will help us greatly in understanding three of the strangest verses in all the Bible, the one that I used to read to my children every night at bedtime. This is 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 23. Then he went up from there to Bethel, and as he was going up by the way, young lads came out from the city and mocked him and said, "Go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head." When he looked behind him and saw them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. Then two female bears came out from the woods and tore up 42 lads of their number. And he went from there to Mount Carmel, and from there he returned to Samaria. I taught my children to obey me. Just kidding.
Or bear the consequences.
That's right. There you go. All right, Charles, I wish you could. All right. What do you imagine? Why do you imagine? Now, you remember Bethel, right? What's going on at Bethel? What is positioned at Bethel?
A priest's school.
Okay, well, there is.
Not priest.
School of the prophets.
Yeah.
There's one of those, but there's also more historically understood. The high places are there. There's a golden calf there. Jeroboam had started his own religion. He had one there and one up in Dan.
Yeah.
They used to come and offer sacrifices there. It was near the border to Judah. He was trying to keep them from going south into Judah. So there was all sorts of sexual women. There was all sorts of distractions that they were providing so that they wouldn't go into Jerusalem because Jeroboam was afraid for his life. But nonetheless, there is a these young lads are not children. The young lads are young adults. They're at least teenagers into their 20s, okay? So they're not little boys scampering around and mocking Elisha. What they are the sons of the prophets, of the false prophets, up on top of Bethel in the high places. And they are mocking Elisha. Now, after everything we've read so far, what do you imagine Elisha has just done?
Shaved his hair off
because he has just completed his vow, special vow to God. And now, having shaved his head, what are they mocking?
His God.
His God. his relationship with his God instead of their nonsense that they're doing. So they are literally mocking God, which is why he can turn around and curse them in the name of Elisha? No. He curses them in the name of God. They're mocking God. Let God have at you. And two female bears come in and takes care of 42 of them. Does this now make some sense? Okay. So this vow of the Nazarite is a big deal. Yes, sir?
Are you going to talk about Paul? No. In Acts?
Go ahead.
There's two passages in Acts where it talks about him cutting his hair initially because he's under a vow.
Yep.
And then when he goes back to Jerusalem, the apostles say, you are under a vow, take these other guys, you have to pay their expenses and have your heads shaved.
Interesting.
So it seems like Paul is doing something along these lines.
I think so, too. Yeah.
Doesn't all make sense.
Great point. But it does tie together, like there's something special going on here. It's not just, hey, you know, Lord. And know this, throughout all the Bible, how important are the vows that we take before God? How seriously does God take your vows? Utterly seriously. Utterly seriously. And the chief vow that most of us are engaged in is what? I hate
divorce.
Now, again, this has no one's condemning anyone who's been through that very difficult situation. The point is, God makes a big deal about vows and oaths. Why?
Because he's involved in it.
Because he's involved in it.
Yeah.
And who doesn't break their vow?
He doesn't.
Oh, he doesn't. So that only means that one of us is breaking our vow. Now, who would that be? Okay, so she has made this vow before God. She has opened her heart. She is distraught. He thinks she's drunk. And then when he accuses her of that, or when he implies that, he says, it's probably not in 2 Kings, sorry. She says, how long will you make yourself drunk? And then Hannah retorts and says, no, my Lord, I am a woman, here we go again, oppressed in spirit. I mean, there are just all these adjectives concerning the heart and the nature and the heartache of Hannah. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. How genuine has her relationship been with God from the moment she walked into that temple to the time that she walked out of it? How sincere and honest was her pleading with God?
I think she was definitely faithful to God and very humble before him.
I think it describes exactly what a genuine heart relationship
she
is
really
with God.
She knew he could.
Who is the other person that happened to be in the room, Kyle, that we had some question about their authentic relationship with God? Oh, that would be the high priest himself. I wonder, do we have any other examples of a high priest of Israel that might have come a little shy of an authentic relationship with God?
Caiaphas.
Annas, Caiaphas, all of them, right? So here she is, genuinely expressing her heart to God and laying open her heart. And she's being judged by, and I'm not condemning Eli, because I think there's indications that he's not the same as his sons, but nonetheless, he's not, you know, being sensitive to her or seemingly sensitive to others at this point. And then when she says, I've poured out my soul before the Lord, do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation. Here we go again. great concern, provocation. I mean, this just keeps going. This poor lady is just, just distraught. Yes.
I love verse 6. I think skip over sometimes a little bit, but it says, "If you do it because the Lord had closed her womb." And guys, when you think about God's sovereignty in this whole thing, what an amazing story that he brings her to this place where, okay, I want a kid real bad so that this other wife will leave me alone and I can be thought of as a great wife now for my husband and yada, 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 whatever. All the reasons that obviously she had for years were not that great until one day she's like, you know what? Now I'm going to pray, but God, I'm also going to say, you know what? I'm going to dedicate this child to you. And what does God do? She has Samuel, one of the greatest prophets in the entire Bible, as a son. And to see his providence and his sovereignty throughout this whole story, he closed her womb, brought her to this place of, you know what, every child is yours, God, so he's dedicated to you if you'll give me a son. And now God says, not only will I give him to you, he's going to be one of the greatest prophets. That,
good point. Yes, sir.
Well, interestingly, I was kind of the same. We're talking about Hannah, Eli, and their question, where's God? And their scripture, he closed her womb. God, in his omnibenevolence, knowing the human condition that she would be chastened, she would be afflicted, she would feel worthless relative to the culture and what her place was as a wife, as a woman. But, okay, Genesis 16, Sarah had no children. What was God in that? And you know, we know it was going to be the offspring of Sarah and relative to Abraham. Also, in Genesis 30, the same situation. There was a desperation to have a child.
We, in fact, went through the whole list of ladies in the Bible that suffered this same situation. It says very clearly that God had closed their womb and then opened it, whether it was Rebecca or Leah, or, I mean, not Leah, but Rachel. And we went forward through Noah's wife. And even we started with Noah's wife for 500 years. But there was a reason and a purpose behind that. Elizabeth, of course. All these different examples show exactly what you were saying.
Do you think that
Audie was that God is not only author's life and opens wounds, and we showed very clearly through Rebecca those three verses that say that Isaac prayed for his wife because she was barren, God had closed her womb. But number two, that then she conceived. We know that life begins at conception, God breathing life into that fetus?
Human being.
Oh, no, because the next verse says, and the two children wrestled. Oh, so life begins at conception, it's a child, and then you give birth. And then we even find out in the womb there's a purpose and a plan for those children. Because God said, two nations are within you. So we spent some time on going through and looking at just how incredibly involved and sovereign God is over these things. Right now we're looking at a contrast that we're making between Hannah and Eli. Eli supposedly being the high priest of, you know, the temple and of all things religious. And here's poor Hannah, who is seemingly sinful and presumed sinful or presumed to be cursed by God or whatever verbiage they may have used in the time. But instead, the exact opposite, for the most part, is true. So when she says, oh no, my Lord, don't consider me a... The words are important. What?
Worthless
woman. Worthless woman. That is not without specific meaning. So he's already identified some of the traits of a worthless woman, and they are drunkenness, right? I mean, just it's wickedness. I mean, if you see how the word is translated, it is it's pretty specific. As a matter of fact, she would be saying, "Don't call me a daughter of Belial." And you can look in 2 Corinthians 6:15, we'll see it's even a New Testament concept. So 2 Corinthians 6. Somebody please read verse 15. What does Christ have in common with a son or daughter of Belial? Absolutely nothing. Because what are they? What is the word?
Does it stand for Satan?
Well, it can, but it's really not so much that as it is a condition. So when it's used, it's really speaking to a condition of wickedness, a condition of lawlessness, a condition of worthlessness. And so what does it say in 2 Corinthians 6:15? And what is in common? Nothing at all. Right. So she's saying, please don't consider me a worthless person. Right? Worthless woman. And it's a specific use of the word. And it's interesting that she would be challenging Eli with that comment. And he is instantly convicted. Instantly. To the point that his retort back to her is no longer judgmental at all. He is responding to what he sees as authentic prayer, authentic relationship, and a plea not to be, you know, accused of being a worthless woman. That's a great point, because even if she had been drunk, he should have said, "My dear, why do you feel compelled to be drinking in the middle of the day and find yourself in the temple? What has so utterly consumed you?" Right? But there isn't any of that. As a matter of fact, he's being confronted by this, and you'll see what I'm saying in just one second. She says, so he immediately just said, he backtracked. Now give him credit for this. That he's convicted by what she has said and what he now knows to be the truth. And his response is this: "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him." He doesn't even ask her what it is. He just sees the authentic nature of it, and he is just saying, "Go in peace. I mean, whatever you have been distraught, I want you to have peace instead of being distraught. And may God answer you your request." Now, we'll see what we're going to continue this in just a second. But before we do, if you don't think irony is part of what God uses in Scripture to teach us, then please go to the second chapter of 1 Samuel. And somebody please read verse 12.
"Now the sons of Eli were worthless men."
What a coincidence that we would use the exact same word. He had assumed she was that because he has seen that before. When had he seen somebody who had been drinking too much coming into the temple of God, do you suppose?
His own sons.
His own sons.
Yes.
And we know what their behavior is, and I don't want to just, I mean, I'm just going to say some things as Scripture does, and we'll pick this up later. They are engaged in theft. First of all, I believe they did drink. I mean, I think that's clear. They're involved in stealing. They're stealing the sacrifices of God. They have changed how things work. And when you brought the sacrifice to God, there were certain portions that were dedicated to God that they were to burn up, including some entrails and some other things, and they were to be burned as a soothing aroma to God, and no one touches those. The second piece of the sacrifice was designated, and they were to be given to the priest. Okay? It was already determined what they were supposed to do. Instead, they come in and start stealing stuff and taking whatever they want, and then demanding some of the raw meat before it's even sacrificed. And the people were saying, no, you can't do this. This is wrong. You can't. This isn't. It's not done this way. And they said, we'll do it by force, right? Well, they wanted the raw meat instead of the cooked meat because they're already taking too much. But if they took the raw meat, what would they do with that?
They'd either sell it.
They'd sell it.
Yeah.
So in other words, they're taking money. I mean, they're extorting from these people who are bringing sacrifices. They're not only taking what they want, but then they're demanding part of it in something that they can sell or negotiate. Then we find out they're sleeping with the women who serve at the front of the meeting. They are worthless, worthless men. Sons of Belial. Look in your margin, you'll see that. Sons of Belial, right? So this wickedness, this lawlessness, this out-of-control nature is something that Eli sadly is familiar with. So for her, he does not call her a worthless woman. You'll see that. She says, I don't want you to think that I am a worthless woman.
Well, you know, Eli being the priest, you would have thought he would have taught his sons better.
Mm-hmm.
Then to allow this kind of behavior, he would have taught them from when they were little all the way up, so they would have better.
You almost think God may have something to say about that.
Yeah.
Which he will.
Preacher's kids are always bad.
It's tough, you know.
It's interesting that he's willing to confront her, but not his own kids.
Oh, yes. Isn't that
special? Yeah. He just looks at someone.
Well, she is not threatening her to him. She doesn't bring home any of that meat or money that was extorted by the son. Oh, wait, that would be self-serving.
Well, those boys were actually stealing from the Lord.
Yes.
They really were.
And their heart condition is really at the root of all this. It's not just the fact that they're stealing, but it's they despise the offering of the Lord.
Yes, they did.
They despise the Lord.
That's exactly correct. And what does it say in verse 12, the end of that verse? We didn't finish reading.
They did not know.
Oh, they didn't know.
Not they didn't know it.
Oh. They
do not say that every child makes their own decision, no matter how they're raised.
Yeah, there's no magic formula.
That's true.
We get that. But a parent does have at their disposal some prohibitions that they can impose upon their children if they're choosing to do a certain thing.
Yes.
Well, it's interesting that he does rebuke them a little bit later, but it says there they would not listen to the voice of their father, but the Lord desired to put them to death.
Yeah. Yeah, we're coming to all this. That's true. That's right. See?
Can we take a rabbit trail for a minute?
Sure.
There's a part of me that says that her whole self-worth is tied up in having a child. And that's the most important thing to her, and she goes to God repeatedly because of that. This part of it says, shouldn't she eventually get to the point where that's not what's most important to her? She says, all right, God, if that's your will, that's okay. And I just want to have a relationship with you. Is that wrong? And that, I mean, God's using that to drive her to him. But it's still something temporal that she's holding on to her own self-worth.
Well, see, that is so brilliant, but I think that's where she started, and that's not where she ended. Her joy becomes her relationship with God, not her son. And that wasn't true to begin with. She was tormented by the fact that she did not have this son. And so we always look at things, and we God is doing something to you. No, he's never doing anything to you. He's doing things for you. So she gets to a point where, like Job, who started off being self-righteous, and he ends in being very humble before God and gives up his self-righteousness. We have Hannah, who begins with clinging to the notion that her self-worth would be found in her son, to the point where I think we find clearly that she is, we're going to see this vow, we aren't there yet, but we're going to, I think we'll get this done. Her keeping her vow is done not out of just obligation. There'll be a degree of joy to what she's doing, and we've got to see how Elkanah is part of this, okay? So let's just finish this one piece of the puzzle so that we don't end on an awkward spot. So here we go. She is now, he says, go in peace, all the rest of it, and look how she changes. Verse 18, and she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went her way and ate. What does that tell you?
She was trusting God.
Yeah.
She suddenly has an appetite. Why did she have an appetite? Why did she not have one before? She was despondent. Why does she have an appetite now?
She's
hopeful.
She has peace.
She has hope. And her face was no longer sad. How did that happen, I wonder? So she is now focusing on a child that she'll have? No, because Eli never said, may God give you a child. He didn't even know what she was asking for. Since may you have peace, and may God grant you what you're looking for. So now she's going away. And so you would think, oh good, let's get home. I can't wait to have a child, whatever. And they arose early in the morning and went home. No. They went early in the morning and worship before the Lord. Now, do you think that her attitude and her worship was any better today than it was the day before? Yeah, let's just say yes.
Yes.
And then they returned again to the house in Ramah, and Elkanah had relations with Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. You know, again, please remember your servant, right? And it came about in due time. Oh, so there's due time after conception, is there? Oh, okay. And what happens after due time? Oh, you give birth. After Hannah had conceived, that she gave birth to a son, and she named him Samuel, which is brilliant, because I've asked him of the Lord. So I've asked of the Lord, that's the meaning of Samuel, but it's more than just having asked of the Lord. There's the response of the Lord answering your ask of the Lord, right? So she has summarized his name brilliantly. Then the man Elkanah went up with all his household to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. Huh. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, I will not go up until the child is weaned. Then I will bring him, that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever. So we could say, well, she's delaying, or she's what? No, she's not. This is the vow she made before the Lord. That she's not talking about not taking him. She's just talking about weaning him first. Then Elkanah, this is very interesting. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. Now let me tell you what that's not saying. The last verse in Judges says, and everyone was doing whatever was right in their minds. This isn't related. This is her doing what was right according to the vow that she made to God. Okay? But he says this, remain until you have weaned him, but, however, hold it. Only may the Lord confirm his word. Now, that may look like strange language. It's anything but. So once again, we're going to go to Numbers. And this time, we're going to go to Numbers 30. Numbers 30. And I'm going to just read a passage out of that so that you can... So the second verse says, if a man makes a vow to the Lord and takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. So if a man makes a vow, who's responsible? That man. Verse 9. But if the vow of a widow or of a divorced woman, everything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. However, talking about women, if she vowed in her husband's house, and clearly a divorced woman and a widow would not be the same person. So if a married woman binds herself or bound herself by an obligation with an oath, and her husband heard it, but said nothing to her and did not forbid her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband indeed annuls them on the day that he hears them, then whatever proceeded out of her lips concerning her vows or concerning the obligation of herself shall not stand. Her husband has annulled them, and the Lord will forgive her. Every vow and every binding oath to humble herself, her husband may confirm it, or her husband may annul it. But if her husband indeed says nothing to her from day to day, then he confirms all her vows or all her obligations which are on her. He has confirmed them because he said nothing to her on the day he heard them. All right. What has Elkanah done? Confirmed her vows, which makes her vow his vow. So he has vowed with his wife to do what? To raise Samuel as a Nazarite and to present him
to the Lord.
To the Lord
when? After he's weaned.
After he's weaned. So he is in complete agreement, but he's warning his wife. He says, listen, it's on me now too. You made this agreement with God. I'm willing to go along with it. It's going to cost me my son too. But we're going to do this, and we're going to honor God, and we're going to, I mean, I'm telling you, this is a good family. I mean, this is God-fearing family. So let's see what they actually do. Back to 1 Samuel. Now, when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with a 3-year-old bull and 1 ephah of flour and a jug of wine and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, although the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull and brought the boy to Eli. Now, again, a godly family doing a godly thing. Here we go again. Back to Numbers. We'll just keep going to Numbers today. Here's what God has to say. God is very specific about this vow. The vow of the Nazarite and everything else. This is what he says. Chapter 15, 9 and 10. In fact, I'll pick up a couple of verses, 2 and 3. But it says, when you make an offering by fire to the Lord, a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a special vow. What's a special vow in this case? Nazarite. Or as a free will offering or in your appointed times to make a soothing aroma to the Lord from the herd or from the flock. And this is verse 8. And when you prepare a bull as a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a special vow, or for peace offerings to the Lord, then you shall offer with the bull a grain offering of 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with 1/2 of a hin of oil. And you shall offer as a libation 1/2 of a hin of wine, an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord. What have they just done? They did exactly according to God's word, exactly what they should be doing. In other words, they know what the vows are. They know how to go about them. They know how to fulfill them. Her behavior and Elkanah's behavior is set so apart from... Do you think that Eli's sons knew what the word of God said concerning sacrifices? Yes. And what portion they were supposed to give? Yes. And do we know for certain they knew they were stealing?
Yes. And do we know, as was said, that they despise the sacrifice of the Lord? Yes. Therefore, they despise God himself? Yes. They are contrasted against each other, one being just a family from Ramah, from the hill country of Ephraim, who just come to town. They know what the law is, and they're fulfilling it completely from their heart, their vow, and what is required. Here, the people are running the show, Eli and his sons, who know the law and are clearly not doing it. Yes.
So, is there any significance to the fact that the bull is 3 years old?
You know, there's some people have said, well, maybe that's how old they set him aside when he was born, and that I'm not sure that's exactly right, because I did actually look this up. The average age of weaning in the world is 4 years, 1 month. And back then, it was more of like 5 years. So for them to bring a child that could be serviceable or helpful in the temple at all, you can't very well bring a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old to Eli. I mean, so it seems likely that he was very young, but not so young that he could not walk, speak, be potty trained, eat, you know. So clearly it was a functional little guy. But yeah, the 3 years has been intimated that maybe that had something to do with it. I think it was.
I feel like there's some pretty great significance to the fact that Elkanah was a priest. Hannah had a desire to dedicate this boy to the Lord. She probably took that seriously every day. And at the same time, looking at Eli's sons and going, I have 3 years or 5 years, whatever it was, to imprint on this young soul a fear and a love for God.
Totally agree. Great observation.
And I just love children. You know, this church used to have an Awana program. I worked with the Cubbies. 3-year-olds totally can understand the truth of the gospel. And young souls are so important to invest in.
Let me give you another parallel feeding off of that. Eli was a what?
Priest.
His sons, therefore, were
priests.
That means they came from the line of
Aaron.
Specifically Levi, and more specifically, Aaron. Elkanah came from the line of Ephraim, which means he came from the line of Joseph. Was he a priest? Samuel could never be a
priest.
Oh, it's a dishonor. That she's bringing an interloper into a situation who was not born of Aaron, who will serve first as a judge, but indirectly as a priest. Right? I mean, Samuel, go anoint. You know, Samuel, go anoint Saul, go anoint David. Do we have anybody else in history who was not born of a Levite, who was not born of Aaron, who actually was, in fact, in all parts a priest, because they came under a different avenue? Now, it's not like Samuel, but Jesus alone, because Melchizedek, like Melchizedek, the only reason Jesus could be qualified as a priest is because he predated the law. He predated Abraham. Before Abraham was, I am. Therefore, Abraham, Isaac, Levi. I mean, Jacob, Levi, right? So before Levi, there were priests. So Christ could be a priest according to the line of Melchizedek. So all these things are fascinating. But here you have somebody who wasn't a priest, who behaved more like a priest than the one who was a priest and acted irresponsibly.
It's interesting to me that Hannah has to put her faith in God when she entrusts Samuel to Eli, because she knows probably that he is not the role model, or he's not going to be the example for Samuel. She's really trusting him to someone who's not righteous.
Wow. She's not trusting Eli at all. Her vow was not Eli. As a matter of fact, let's finish this. She comes several years later and says, I'm the woman who stood beside you. I was praying to the Lord. And I was praying for this boy. And God heard me, he answered me, he blessed me, and here is the boy. I dedicated him before he was conceived. I dedicated him when he was conceived. I dedicated him before he was born. I dedicated him when he was born. And I've dedicated him since he was born. And I've brought him to be given to God. I'm dedicating him right now. I'm bringing him to the Lord with a conflict, not a conflict, but a tension in my heart. I'm bringing him with utter joy that God gave him to me and that God fulfilled this. But I'm also bringing him with some heartache that I'm giving him, you know, I won't be seeing him on a regular basis. So it's this mixture, as Steve was alluding to before. Is she doing it with joy? Is she doing it with reluctance? Is she doing it? And I think as time is wearing on, she is being all in on this. I'm bringing him with both joy and heartache. And God has a special purpose for him. That I know. He was... Look, and here's something she's saying about her as well, I think. All these things, I dedicated him at all these times. But wait, I was dedicated to the Lord before this child was born. I was, before he was conceived, I was devoted to the Lord when I was pregnant. I was devoted to the Lord when he was born. I was devoted to the Lord while I was weaning him. And I'm still devoted to the Lord. Now again, this is in great contrast to who she's even talking about. We'll finish this with this verse. This is 1 Samuel chapter 2, 18 to 21. Now Samuel was ministering before the Lord as a boy wearing a linen ephod. And his mother would make him a little robe and bring it to him from year to year when she would come up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, May the Lord give you your children. May the Lord give you children from this woman in place of the one she dedicated to the Lord. And they went on their way home. Then the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and gave birth to 3 sons and 2 daughters, and the boy Samuel grew before the Lord. Yeah. Was God doing anything to her? From day one, he was doing things for her. There are so many takeaways in this of us trusting God, even when it appears that God isn't hearing us, even when it appears that the world is judging us or thinking less of us because of our righteous behavior, that all things are working together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose. You either believe that or you don't. You either walk in that or you don't. You either believe in a sovereign God or you don't. It's not a little bit pregnant. It's not a little bit believing any of that. It is absolutely sold out to that and understanding that God knows exactly what he's doing. He has a plan that we can rejoice in, even if we can't see the forest or the trees. And trusting him and relying on his sovereignty and him proving himself again and again and again and again just gives us that change of heart that I believe Steve was intimating, that with time and experience, all things can turn to joy and trust and relationship with God. And it's about him and not it's the giver of gifts, not the gift. It's God himself and not what he's done that we should be enamored with. But I'm so sorry. Let's talk out loud. We're way past it. Father, please go with us now and just encourage us and put on our hearts just this great contrast between doing it right and doing it wrong. I pray that you give us that love and joy in our hearts for you and not simply for what you do. In Christ's name, amen.
Those of you who need to